Hello, it's Vanessa again at Beyond the Room, and I'm here at the Attune Project this afternoon talking about pathways to amphetamine use from a variety of perspectives. And I've just managed to catch Claire. And Claire, for people who are listening online who can't be here today and have just found out about the Attune Project by following the hashtag on Twitter, could you just share some thoughts about why you're here today?
Yeah, so I'm here today. I've just completed my master's at Newcastle University. It was based on interventions for chemsex, which is, for those who don't know, it's a specific type of drug use which is enhances sexual encounters. So the types of drugs are crystal methamphetamine, which of course fits within this remit, GHB, and methadone also fits within this. So I suppose that's why my interest has drawn me here. Today there was a lot of talk about hedonism, which I found incredibly interesting. Unfortunately, sexuality wasn't recorded within the petition, so it was probably a little bit of a missed opportunity. But that was one of the three factors, was hedonism, functional, and the third one was environmental, I think. So the role that hedonism plays with, I suppose, ATS use, and how people use these particular drugs, amphetamines, ecstasy, to kind of enhance their sexual experience, enhance their relationships with other people. So I suppose that's an interesting area of mine that I'm interested in. My research focused on people who access meal exchange services, so predominantly injecting drug users of amphetamines.
Injecting amphetamines.
So injecting crystal meth or injecting methadone, which is commonly associated with chemsex. So I suppose that is another aspect of the research which I'm looking forward to hearing more about, is did they record how individuals or participants used these particular drugs, were they using pills, were they using powder, were they snorting, were they ingesting, were they injecting, and kind of, you know, building a bigger picture on that kind of, on the ATS drug use.
So how prevalent is the sort of chemsex?
It's a kind of a difficult thing to say, and I think there's been a lot of discussion today about treatment and access to treatment, and you know how this kind of drug use is perceived to fit within that spectrum of treatment, and because they are they're kind of built for opiate and alcohol use, which I think other colleagues have said today. So chemsex, in the terms of treatment, it would fit an extended brief intervention unless there's GHB dependency, which would look at clinical intervention. But beyond that, this is seen as a phenomenon among the gay community. From my research.
Is it mainly the gay community?
Yeah, it's predominantly gay men, or men who have sex with men is the common term that's used. I think I did a piece of research where I interviewed 17 practitioners who deliver interventions in needle exchange services. And for the most part, they said that they were not seeing this cohort of injecting drug users. However, other research would indicate, particularly in specialist treatment services for chemsex, that this is actively happening within the community. And people within the gay community would also say that this is happening. It's there. There's active use. And there's it's a high-risk type of drug use, really high-risk type of drug use. So to be able to have a recorded kind of a figure for you, we don't have that.
No.
I suppose, but it's something about making people more aware of what that looks like and what kind of services you can offer for that type of drug use.
Would people be, because obviously injecting drugs and amphetamines is quite an extreme thing to do, would that just be associated with chemsex, or is this in a population of people who are using drugs for other reasons as well?
So interestingly, it is commonly associated with men who have sex with men. You know, there was some reports from practitioners that they had seen women who were using GHB in heterosexual relationships, and people were using it in a hedonistic type of way. the combination of this drug use is what makes it unique to Chemsex.
Yeah.
We're using two kind of stimulants, well, a really potent crystal meth, a really potent stimulant, methadrone, to top up that kind of high, which, you know, which brings you to this certain level. They're commonly using Viagra as well. You know, these sessions may go on for kind of a long time. And then they're using GHB, you know, because they're so high. It's a facilitator for certain sexual acts as well. So I think these three combination drugs together,
yeah,
they're within the Chemsex remit. GHB could be used more commonly in the wider population.
Yeah.
And I suppose crystal methamphetamine, it's kind of hard to get.
Yeah, yeah.
Get hold of outside London. You know, people travel to London for that. But methadrone was a legal high.
Yeah.
Or a novel psychoactive substance. And before 2010, it was really popular, like, yeah, as a clubbing drug.
Yeah.
And it moved out of that and into it, right. When it became illegal, it moved into illicit markets. But it just so happens that with these three drugs together, they fit really nicely for the kind of for Chemsex, for this kind of really high intimate relationships with men, yeah, lots of partners. It works for that.
Yeah.
It's quite unique.
So is this a group that wouldn't necessarily see themselves as having problematic drug use?
Absolutely.
And wouldn't necessarily access treatment? That's what
Absolutely.
I was thinking.
I suppose, yeah, one thing that did come out of my research was LGBTQ in drug treatment services.
Yeah.
There wasn't, although there was a real push for inclusivity among staff.
Yeah.
They were saying they weren't seeing LGBTQ people in treatment services, which is a real big concern, and something that I suppose needs much further research into kind of why we're not seeing people,
yeah,
from the LGBT community accessing services,
exactly,
accessing needle exchange
that,
services.
Yeah.
Like, it just, and it, you know, is this type of drug use a specialist, does it fit in wider mainstream services? You know, that's a personal opinion for me, is that all drug use should be able to access mainstream services. But I think I've gone on a little bit of a tangent there, have
it's
I?
All right, no, it's fine. Were there any barriers to people participating in this study from this kind of population of drug users?
So, interestingly, I actually come from a background as a practitioner. So
right.
Prior to this, I worked in treatment services for many years, and there was no barrier to people participating, except for they didn't feel like they had any knowledge.
Yeah.
So that was practitioners who delivered interventions didn't feel like they had the appropriate knowledge, hadn't maybe engaged with this cohort of drug users. But barriers were that they didn't see people. They weren't, you know, I think one of the glaringly obvious things is that nobody was trained or had any training, or kind of their knowledge was what I kind of said was, you know, they went and looked, you know, they self-taught themselves almost.
Yeah.
Google was one of the big sources,
yeah,
where people got their information for these drugs.
Yeah.
Others was like television series, like, so that, you know, the way they were learning, and the, you know, people did have clients that they engaged with, their knowledge was from, I suppose, so I wouldn't say they weren't credible, but potentially,
yeah,
they might not have been.
Yeah.
Which is a big concern and a big gap.
Massive.
Within treatment, really.
Yeah, yeah. So the ATTUNE study is obviously looking at amphetamine use in the Northeast and in Europe. Are you aware of any differences with the cohort that you're talking about between this use in the UK and in Europe?
From research that I have read, Chemsex is, you know, there's a huge scene in London, but it has spread beyond Europe.
Right.
You've got like Italy, you've got, you know, all the big cities, basically.
Yeah.
Is what's been fed back is that the big cities are all, you know, in some aspects there's this kind of activity going on. So it's not just like a niche thing. It may have begun,
yeah,
in some regards, within like South London, within a particular tribe that's based down there, you know, is it like a perfect kind of place for this to begin? But beyond that, you know, like people travel all over the world, they're able to hook up through these apps quite easily. You're able to find, use the geolocation dating apps and find each other that has find other people that have similar interests to you and engage in that, no matter what that kind of looks like. But that kind of high risk sexual behavior, it's happening all over Europe and in cities like New York, etc. It just is about getting more research and evidence around what that looks like in different parts of the world.
What about in terms of ethnicity, just thinking from a like intersectional perspective?
Around, is this like is this predominantly white?
I
don't see that as being it's about men who sex with men. That's the predominant identifier almost. That as far as I can see, ethnicity wasn't a barrier, you know. It's just about people having these similar interests in this kind of like really intense sexual parties, you know. There's loads of like interesting anecdotes that I could give you about how they strategize and reduce harm amongst themselves, which is why they don't actually, I suppose, lean on treatment services per se. But, you know, what's been reported is that people that engage in chemsex, it's not a particular demographic. It's across the board, to doctors, nurses, teachers, you know, from all walks of life. I've had clients who I've met who've come from, you know, lots of different backgrounds. The interesting thing is the age. The majority of people are over 30s.
Right.
Which is contrast to what was said today. Which makes, you know, this mature now that was mentioned today, is what you'd see with chemsex, is it was men over 30s, 40s, you know. Some of them were, what was being reported is, you know, like people that used to work in the sex industry that had quite a lot of money, you know, people with disposable income. And one participant said that, you know, the reason why they don't run into trouble where, you know, because they have lots of disposable income, they'd have never had children, or they might not want children, so they haven't had that resource. So they've got extra money, and because they haven't had to, I suppose, take some time out in their career for children or any, they've been really successful. And you know, and that's kind of like, that's what's unique about this cohort as well. And they can party for 4 days straight without any and get up and go to work on a Monday without any other kind of like factors that will influence that, around like they don't have children to attend, they don't have, like at the weekend I know I have to go to football, and you know, they don't have those, they can just kind of like
concentrate
across the board. We've seen it, like younger age range for some people that maybe they move to a new environment, like they've moved to London for the first time, they want to get involved in the scene, and you know, it's a rite of passage in that way into this kind of into the scene that they've never been a part of. It's a whole new identity.
Yeah.
But predominantly, we're seeing it in an older cohort.
Interesting. Yeah, fascinating. Thank you.